chairs with you. Okay. So you have the phones, and someone should be speaking to you directly.
Oh, yeah?
They're on the other end. I can hear papers shuffling around.
Can you just leave me alone in this with all
I'm
of these?
Leave you quiet yet. I'm going to make sure you guys are communicating properly.
Hello.
And I'm in the office right across the hall, so when you're through speaking with them, just let me know, and I'll make sure we drop our lines and everything like we should. Somebody should talk to you here in a second.
Hello?
Hello.
Hi, it's Krista Tippett.
Hello, Krista.
You're not really alone.
Okay. I hope you haven't been. Have you been watching that stream from University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign? Or did you get to see that?
No, what is it?
Oh, well, I gave it to Jody last
night.
Oh,
yes, I did. Oh, yeah. Is that what that was? No, I was listening to part of it.
Okay. Well, I'm sorry. There were lots of ums and ahs in it because I'd just flown in from Europe and I was really exhausted.
Oh.
So it was a dreadfully long and tedious lecture, I think. So.
Well, I didn't listen to the whole thing. I'd done most of my preparing, and I had it in the background as I was arranging my notes. So it was fine. I got a couple of new things out of it. But
okay, great.
No need to apologize.
Is it all set up? I've got a guy here who's nodding his head rather than shaking his head. So yeah. Where am I supposed to be relative to this microphone? Can I be anywhere? Or
I would speak directly on mic if you can't. Just yeah, you know, I mean, you're fine right there.
I'm light here.
Just don't get off side of the mic. If you get off axis, they'll have a hard time hearing you.
Okay.
So just stay in front of it.
All right. Okay. Well, I'm all yours.
Okay. Great. Yeah. I think you sound good, Mitch. Do you want us to talk about what he had for breakfast to get? Or are you all right?
Mary had a little lamb. Oh. Nobody could figure out how Mary had a little lamb.
No, I don't hear an echo. I'm great. Should we just go? Okay. All right. Do you have any questions of me before we begin?
Just be nice. And
I always am.
And cut out all the swear words. Sorry.
Okay, I can do that too. Say your name for me. I want to know how you say it. Is it just Freer?
Andrew Freer. Yeah.
All right. Okay.
Other people call me different things.
All right. I really liked this description of you and the architectural record: a gonzo spirit with a disciplined mind and a sophisticated aesthetic.
Oh, God.
Did you like that, too?
The gonzo. Can you say it again?
A gonzo spirit with a disciplined mind and a sophisticated aesthetic. You don't have to comment.
I'm not going to.
Okay.
I'm getting a little bit of feedback. Am I supposed to?
No, you shouldn't. Let's see what we can do at this end. Talk to me now. Tell me something. Tell me what you had for lunch, and let's see if you still hear it.
Well, I actually just had lunch with the head of University of Alabama Art Department, and that was fun because he's one of our biggest supporters, and it's that might sound strange to somebody else, but the University of Alabama and Auburn University are sworn enemies. So the fact that we had lunch together was one of those. It was potentially a mixed marriage kind of thing, you know. So,
Are you still hearing that feedback, or are you do sound okay?
Am I still hearing that feedback? I think it's okay now.
Okay.
No, it's still there. It's still there. Yeah. Sorry.
No, that's all right. We've turned down my headphones, which sometimes makes a difference. Why don't you talk some more and just see for yourself if you can.
Talk some more.
Mm-hmm.
It's better.
Is it? Okay.
Well, it's actually still there, but it's okay.
I heard a little feedback there too. I do too. Yeah. Can you turn your headphones down, or ask whoever's there, engineer, producer, to help you turn your headphones down a little bit and see if that.
I'd better not start twiddling all these knobs.
Okay.
So
they can.
I'll just run and get him. Do you want me to do that?
Oh.
Go and ask him?
Okay. We'll call him.
Okay.
You just. Did you move away from the mic?
I did, yes.
Oh, okay, okay.
I ran off into the corner.
All right.
I didn't touch anything.
No, no. This happens every time. We always have to adjust this, but it will drive you crazy if you have that echo. You can't hear yourself speak, so we need to get rid of it. So Mitch is calling the control room and
okay.
Do you have any they could come down a little bit. I mean, do you have any questions of me about while they're talking to each other about the show or could you turn me up just a little bit, though, Mitch? I can hardly. Okay, that's better.
I have to confess that I haven't listened to any of the CDs that was sent to me.
That's
so
fine.
All I read was a little bit of the email that you sent to Linda, and that the subjects are sustainability. Mm-hmm. The general subject is sustainability, mm-hmm. and there's also this quote about commitment to charity is a good virtue that needs to be renewed. And
I didn't write that, but okay.
No. That's a Mockbee thing. I'm not so sure.
Oh, that's Mockbee.
About that one.
Okay.
Yeah. But that was something that was
all right. Well, I mean, this is a national. It's a public radio program that's national and weekly, and we get a whole hour to explore a subject. The program is called Speaking of Faith, but we take a really broad view of what this whole part of life is—faith, religion, spirituality—in all its variety and complexity. And we don't, and we often, you know, we're not always often talking about religion, but about.
Okay.
Other subjects of human life and of our common life and and kind of the virtues and the morality as well perhaps as spiritual underpinnings or perspectives that come out of what different people do. But I think from what I've read, we're going to have a good conversation here. So
well, I think,
Mitch, are you... oh, he can't reach the engineer.
Oh, he can't? You want me to go find him? Mary had a little lamb.
I hate for you to have to go find him.
I don't think I'm getting feedback now.
Okay.
No, I'm not.
All right. Well, then let's just go. I'm not actually hearing myself either, so maybe it magically fixed itself.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, where I'd like to start is by hearing just a little bit of your story about, I mean, you... you're from Yorkshire, is that right? You grew up in Yorkshire?
That's right.
Okay.
That's right.
And you studied architecture in London. Sounds like you were in Chicago. And then how did you hear about the rural studio? And what was your first encounter with it?
I guess my first encounter with... I'd seen a little bit in the press. You know, I'm still getting feedback, unfortunately. Mm. Sorry.
Do
you want me to go find him?
Yeah, maybe you should if we can't reach him. Sorry. Okay.
I can sense it's going to become irritating.
Yeah, so. No, it all will.
All right, hold on.
Okay.
Okay. No problem. Getting some echo coming back to you in a bit. Sure you can still hear them, but I could probably reduce your headphone level quite a bit.
Oh, is that it? I can hear myself even more now.
Hmm.
Hello?
Are you
I
echoing?
I think that's better.
You think it's better?
That's better.
Okay.
Yeah, that's much better.
All right. Start talking for a minute and let's make sure.
Okay, don't. Can you just wait one second?
Yeah, tell them what.
Yeah, it's still there.
Hmm. Yeah, we don't want it there. We don't want it there.
No. Okay, I try again.
Okay.
I think that's better. Yeah, that's better.
You know what I think it may be if you don't lean maybe quite so much into the mic.
Okay, if I'm speaking from here.
Well, I like the way you sound.
That's too far.
Yeah. But maybe just, you might think about...
That sexy Yorkshire accent, isn't it?
I like it. I lived in England for a couple of years.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, I recognize Yorkshire accent. Oh, I lived in Wiltshire.
Well, mine's a Yorkshire accent that's been well screwed up by West Alabama.
Yeah, I know, but
I can still hear
it.
I say y'all.
I heard you say that in the video, but I still hear the Yorkshire and you haven't gotten rid of it.
Okay, it's good now.
Okay.
Yeah, definitely good now.
All right.
Is the engineer still in the room?
All
right, thank you.
Actually, can I get his phone number?
Wait, could Mitch have his phone number?
Okay.
Mitch wants your phone number.
Well,
Hey, we're into anything in West Alabama.
Hey, Mitch, the number's 205-348-8026.
Okay, I tried calling that before, but I got no answer. So that's your, I got your voicemail. But you'll answer that?
Okay. Hello?
Hello.
All right.
Can you hear me?
Yeah, let's try.
All right.
All right. Okay. So you read about Rural Studio? Did you read about it when you were still in England, or was it when you came over here?
I'd seen a little bit about it in England, but honestly, it started to get some national press or architectural press when I was living and working in Chicago, and I happened one night to go along to the Graham Foundation and see Samuel Mockbee lecture, and I was blown away by his personality, his spirit, and also, quite honestly, just his belief in what he was doing. And it was so refreshing to find an architect who was so totally and utterly immersed in his craft and his art and his activity. And he had a huge impact. I mean, I think that a lot of people will say that when you met Sambo, he had such an extraordinary kind of captivating personality, a sort of personality that's capable of dealing and appealing to people in Mustang Oil in Greensboro, West Alabama, or sort of an art gallery in New York. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was capable of bridging all of those gaps. And I fell in love with his passion and his desire and his delight in what he'd found in West Alabama, and also that he was doing something of worth.
Right.
I mean, I struggled. I was living in Chicago for about 6 years, and both being a teacher and a practitioner, and I don't know. I mean, I was educated by a group of people in England and in London who had rebuilt England after the Second World War. They believed that they could change the world and make the world a better place and do a lot of good. And so, you know, I was the sort of one of those dreamy souls that felt that if I was going to do this, I may as well do something of worth, if you like. And I think it's nice. I mean, it's a fantastic opportunity to be able to educate young people, but also at the same time be able to give a better quality of life to a few people in West Alabama. And I was very lucky.
Did you start up a conversation with Samuel Mockbee then?
I can't say that I did. Mm-hmm. In fact, he probably said, "Get out of the way," or something. You know, yeah. He was. No, we didn't speak to each other at all. But I went away from it and continued to teach and practice in Chicago. And at some point sort of was spinning my wheels in both and decided that I'd like to sort of perhaps concentrate a little bit more on teaching. And I threw some resumes in the mail and forgot about it. And then the next minute I had a response from Auburn. And I knew that Auburn University, I knew that Samuel Mockbee worked at Auburn University, but I didn't exactly know where Auburn University was.
Right.
So much to my surprise, I arrived in Atlanta and went over to Auburn, and they offered me a job. So I worked on the campus at Auburn for a year, and during that time got to go out to West Alabama, which is actually 3 hours away from the university, and be on juries and look at the work that Sambo and the team were doing out there, and just was, you know, captivated by it. And at the end of that year, by luck or by judgment, Sambo just he essentially asked me if I'd come out and work with him. And I think there was about enough money to last until Christmas. There wasn't a great deal of money, and so it was just somewhat an act of faith.
Right.
You know, for me, the rest is sort of history. I mean, it's been a really wild ride, and it's a an extraordinarily kind of optimistic and enthusiastic environment. I mean, young people having the opportunity to build is really quite something. I mean, the carrot of an opportunity to build and to build for people and not just sort of be the toys of the rich and famous that architects normally have, and to do, you know, some projects of social worth. I mean, Steve Berdanes, who often comes and visits, who's an architect who's been doing design build for an awful long time, is so incredibly jealous of the number of public projects that we actually get to do in West Alabama. And in some respects, we've become sort of West Alabama's architect.
Right. Tell me, I want to just stop right now before you... Are you okay with the... Are you having the echo still at all?
No, it's
okay.
Okay,
all right. Mitch, you could turn my headphones down a tiny bit and... Okay, good. I've read someplace that you wrote... that you were the utilitarian socialist and Mockbee was the artist who said, make it pretty.
It's very refreshing.
Tell me what you learned, you know, what you took into that relationship, about the relationship between the two of you and what you learned from him.
I mean, from a the way that, I think that we actually worked very well together, because, I mean, it's actually quite refreshing in academia where you meet a teacher, and Sambo was certainly a fantastic teacher. I mean, his personality, he was able to, like I said before, he could engage with absolutely anybody, and so people felt very comfortable in his presence. And there was no sort of academic pretension to the way that he operated, and so there was no, it didn't, there were, I mean, it's not to say that it wasn't intellectual, but it was absolutely stunningly refreshing to be with somebody who would profess to finding something, one thing more beautiful than another, and not being able to really articulate why. He just said, you know, this is pretty and this isn't. And, you know, you could talk about it all day, but he was right. You know?
Could you see what he saw when he described it?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, there's a, I mean, the sort of the, just the character, I mean, it's very hard to describe, but sort of the characteristic, Sambo always used the term stomango, and every project always needed a little bit of stomango, something a little bit extra special, and, he was always, you know, you always had to, and we've had, you know, numerous discussions about how in making architecture and making building projects, particularly when you're on such low budgets, that, you know, you have to choose your moments. And he would always say that you need at least one moment or one piece of stomango in your project to lift it above the ordinary. Mm. And, you know, as you know, his sort of clarion call was to make architecture or people homes for people warm, dry, and noble. And it's that noble thing. There's various ways of describing that noble. It might make you laugh. It might make sort of spiritually inform you or enhance your life. But give it something extra because typically the folks that we work with will say to you, well, just give me something, because anything is better
than
I've got.
Mm-hmm.
And that doesn't really satisfy us, and certainly doesn't satisfy our students. And they're so sort of outrageously ambitious. And the nice thing that I think the Royal Studio offers is sort of the time and the opportunity to be ambitious. I mean, the students can... I say to them at the beginning of the year, you can make this absolutely what you want it to be and aspire to really great things for yourself and for your client.
Aspiring to making noble buildings is actually quite a lovely idea. Well,
yes,
I want to ask you some big ideas about architecture and, you know, what you're doing and what it means to you. But I think maybe a good way to start to make sure that we're not abstract is for you to just describe for me right now. Say talk to me about a project that you're really passionate and excited about right now that's underway, or you've just finished, or, you know, something that you're...
Oh, my goodness. Well, there's too many, but My particular delight at the moment is a little house called the $20,000 house. It's a house that's inspired by a rural development grant that is given out. That is 20,000. It's actually a, I guess I should describe it as a $20,000 loan, and it's to the poorest of the poor, typically those that are on welfare, and they can qualify for this loan. And the prerequisite of the loan is that you go and you use this loan to build yourself a home. Now, the one caveat to that is that at the moment there isn't a model at the moment for the $20,000 house. Even if I get the $20,000 loan, there isn't a model out there that actually qualifies under the rural development and HUD regulations for me to go out and build it.
Right.
So it's a little bit dubious, and some might say suspicious. But what we have actually tried to do is say, well, can we build for $20,000? And of course the prerequisite is $20,000 built by a builder. So what we have said is, let's see what we can actually build ourselves for $10,000 in materials, mm-hmm. understanding that our labor is free, so we build into that. With, you know, there is an assumption that the other $10,000 would go to overhead and to costs and to for some degree mm-hmm. of profit for a builder. So our goal has been to build these $20,000 houses for $10,000 in materials. And we've just finished the third one, which is essentially a dog trot house. It's a dog trot house. It's two forms with a breezeway in between. So it's a kind of a porch that's trapped between two buildings. Oh. And it's about 800 square feet, and it's a really beautiful thing. And what we have an opportunity to do at the Rural Studio versus the profession and the builders and the contractors out there is that we can actually go and explore something like this and not lose our shirt. I mean, mm-hmm. in some respects, I think in academia we have a responsibility. I have students who are sort of free labor at the moment with all of these different ideas, and so we're going out there and testing them and trying to come up with the right $20,000 house that we can then hand off to a contractor and say, look how fast you can build this. You can actually make some money doing this. And we're looking in the future, I hope in the next 2 or 3 years, to let a builder build these things and to have them scattered around Hale County.
But
so it's actually pretty
the,
ambitious.
Would they all be the same, or would they all be...
It's, you know, for $10,000 in materials, mm-hmm. it's very difficult to say that they can all be the same. I think what we would hope is that the client begins to personalize them. But certainly the framework and the way that the building touches the ground and the way that it's enclosed would be the same. But you would hope that the orientation... we could certainly move the windows around a little bit, but mm-hmm. for that small amount of money, you're really scratching out some architecture. But the one we've just done, I think, is spectacular. I think it could last 150 years. It's very smart. It's lifted off the ground. It only touches the ground in six places. There's a minimal use of concrete. It's really highly insulated. It has good ventilation. It's got a beautiful outdoor space, and it's very clever. And I mean, we've built on this idea over the last 3 years, and my hope, really and truly, genuinely, is that not only can we help sort of solve some of the housing problems in West Alabama, but it will also give somebody a job, that a builder will begin to go and make a living doing this and give jobs to other people.
Who's going to be living in that house you just described to me?
In that particular house are a couple of brothers. Mm-hmm. And that was the reason actually for the dog trot configuration.
Mm-hmm.
That we started to look at the way that people lived in West Alabama, and there was an awful lot of sort of situations or conditions of extended families. And you'd often find a mother or a grandmother with a daughter or a daughter-in-law living with a younger child. So there would be sort of different generations living together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not often that architecture sort of responds to that kind of family dynamic. And particularly in that kind of social sphere, there's sort of quite a lot of that happens. And so this, the two brothers living together, actually is sort of an ideal condition. And the hopefully our hope, and of course we will watch how they live in it, because that's the other thing, is that we give this house away. Mm-hmm. These are experiments, so they
and
give
then
it
you
away
learn from what happens.
And we sit back and watch, mm-hmm. and we listen and we learn, and we say, well, you know, they might not know that they're living this way, but they're, you know, it's this worked and this didn't work. And so next year we'll build on that conversation and improve on that. And it's again, it's a privilege that I think we have. And in some respects, I think we have an obligation to do things like this, because I don't know that anybody else can, you know. So,
you know, I want to ask you. Go on. What are you going
to
say?
The opportunity that the Rural Studio projects provide is sort of extraordinary. I mean, there's so much ambition and enthusiasm and such a can-do nature. But this particular project is a project where every penny counts. Mm-hmm. So they're counting every nail and every screw that they put in this, so they know exactly how much money it costs.
Literally every penny counts.
Yeah, and it's literal. Right. And it's there's no donations. We don't allow any donations. It's here's what it would cost if I went to my local store and I bought all of these pieces. So we really know that it can work. But for me, it's incredibly powerful, just simply because it's trying to scratch a little bit of nobility or a little bit of architecture out of really very little. And it's a project for an architect with grey hair, not for a 22-year-old. And what they're doing for 22-year-olds is really incredible, I have to say. So I'm very proud of it.
Right.
So.
Well, you know, I want to ask you about you being there. One thing Samuel Mockbee wrote, and he does seem to have been a wonderfully wise and quotable person, was architecture.
Yeah, it depends who you ask.
Architecture, more than any other art form, is a social art and must rest on the social and cultural base of its time and place. Mm. And he was a fifth generation Mississippian. Mm. And so the social dynamics and cultural dynamics of Hale County, Alabama were, I mean, that was his world in a sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
And there you are. And he tells this story about an epiphany he had driving outside his home in Mississippi and stopping and pulling over and finding himself by the grave of one of the three civil rights workers who was killed in the summer of 64, James Chaney.
That's right.
And he wrote about how he's come to believe that James Chaney defines who he was and who he was not. He said, you know, his courage was a gift to me and to all of us. As architects, we are given a gift and with it a responsibility. Mm. Do we have the courage to make our gift count for something? I'm elaborating on this because he went to this place, but he was of this place and he understood its social dynamics. And I'm curious about what drew you to this place. And what keeps you there, and how do you relate to, what was that phrase? To the social and cultural base of this architecture's time and place.
Yeah. Goodness. There must be. I think the locals really like my funny accent. When I came to West Alabama, I didn't. There's a lot of people who want to write the world, there have been well documented issues in this part of the world, and I wouldn't pretend to. I've gone into the situation not pretending to know a great deal about them. I think that one of my best attributes is that I can actually listen and learn. Sambo Mockbee was a fifth generation Mississippian, so it was deeply ingrained in culturally and his life. And For me, in some respects, all of that's quite overwhelming. I mean, I hope what I bring, I would hope I bring no baggage to the table. I mean, I think that that's actually quite important, that people have embraced. I mean, I say it's actually not a it's not a ridiculous thing to say that people enjoy my accent. I mean, I think they're kind of curious as to why someone from England would end up in West Alabama,
right,
and be living with a bunch of students in the middle of nowhere. And it's the truth of the matter is it's at times it can be intensely lonely. There aren't any of the cultural things that you all have when you live in a city. I mean, there's no great bars and there's no great restaurants and there's no great theater, but you make your bed and you lay in it, and working with the students and engaging with the locals who I've seen extraordinary acts of giving and extraordinary acts of commitment from people that really don't have very much. Mm-hmm. And the nice thing about the students, in the same way that in some respects I have, is that I don't come to the table with any baggage. I am who I am. The students are also very young, and they want to come and do something. They want to come and be positive. Mm-hmm. And you bring a sort of an energy to a place. And where we live, I mean, I have to say, the educational system's pretty poor. It's really terribly underfunded. And all of the people that, those few people that do manage to get a good education, the young people, they leave. Mm-hmm. And so for in this situation, bringing young people into what is a relatively aging community has had actually a huge and powerful impact. They really love it. Mm. They witness that, and they enjoy that, and they engage with them. Our students are incredibly popular. I mean, you know, there's always ridiculous rumors about students, but that's always going to happen somewhere. But at the same time, I think they have an incredible respect for just how positive and how hard our students do work. Mm-hmm. And I think from my point of view, I was very lucky that I didn't come into the situation with any baggage other than a silly English accent, and people have been very generous to me.
Let me ask you this, though. Did you bring, you know, you said you were galvanized by Samuel Mockbee when you first heard him in Chicago, and that you were trained by architects who literally rebuilt England after World War II. I mean, did you bring a sense of the link between social responsibility and architecture, or architecture as a social art? Did you bring that in a different way, with a different background from?
I hope so. I'm intensely positive about the public realm. Mm-hmm. Part of the Rural Studio program that has blossomed since I arrived is the public projects, the community projects.
The community center buildings as opposed to just private homes.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. I mean, they've really thrived, and the sort of people's imagination has taken off. And what the beautiful thing for me about that is that you obviously, if you make a piece of public architecture, you have the opportunity to touch more people. I mean, last year we worked on a 40-acre public park in West Alabama. We were engaged with the hospital in Greensboro, Hale County Hospital, and we worked on the Hale County Animal Shelter. And I would argue in those three buildings, we've touched more people in those three buildings than we previously did perhaps with all of the projects that we've ever done. And the projects get bigger, and there's some criticism of the project getting bigger. But I think that the belief, it might suggest that I'm a socialist, I do believe in the public realm. I believe in good local and central government, and I believe in the role that they can play.
And that's a good Yorkshire tradition as opposed to an Alabama tradition.
Perhaps, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think that they're also tremendous local politicians, even in the place that I'm working, that doesn't perhaps have any great tradition of that, who are incredibly public and civic-minded and are struggling against such deep ingrained lack. I mean, the poverty of the funding is ridiculous to have any imagination for taking on public projects. I mean, very often we're taking on public projects simply because there's a little bit of money, but there's not enough money to actually hire somebody to do the job, or to do it well enough. And were able, because of, you know, essentially the labor of the students and our intensity and the sort of the gift of our time, to make that money go much further, mm-hmm. and even be able to employ local contractors, because the projects are big enough where you can actually say, look, you can come and do the roof for us. And mm-hmm. so that money starts to be spent and spread much further. And I think it's, I hope that everybody wins. You know, the local communities get to enjoy the fruits of the projects. The students get a terrific education. I mean, I'm in an academic setting which is sort of second to none. I mean, I have the students in such an incredibly focused situation. There's no baggage of everyday life. They don't have to worry about the amount of time it gets to work. They don't have to worry about finding their way to
the
grocery store.
They kind of live the projects for the
They live the project. They mm-hmm. come there to build a dog shelter. They come there to build a fire station. That's mm-hmm. what they do. And it may well be the most focused and intense period of their entire lives, and it's very intense. And I mean, that's the fatiguing thing for me, is that there's such an intensity to it, but it's also quite a drug. And I think that you know, the students do remarkable things and get remarkable. I mean, they meet people, it allows us to bring people together who would never ever under normal circumstances come together, and that's just a terrific joy, honestly.
You know, if people, citizens, public radio listeners, have thought about building for low-income areas or for low-income people, they probably, the most closest association they might have is with Habitat for Humanity, which I think is about building as opposed to architecture. But I mean, how would you describe what the difference is in these kind of different undertakings?
Mm. I have to be careful here.
Well, I'm not asking you to put that down, but sort of say, what is the particular value that the architectural...
Again, I think my view would be it would be lifting the spirit. And I mean, there's an example...
That's what architecture does, is that what you mean?
I hope so. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it takes it up to that next level. And sometimes you can't quite state exactly what that is, but it's that just that little bit extra something that's not really quantifiable. It's just, you know, it's Sambo's little bit of Stamango, I think, that makes them feel special. I mean, it's you know, people often will ask me, well, what do the clients really think to this and what you've done here? Because it doesn't really look like anything else around. And my response is that typically the client will say, you know, this just makes me feel so good because I know that nobody anywhere else in the world has got something like this, and that makes me feel very special.
Because house is so so designed and so much has so much participation.
It's absolutely, and it's very, very distinct. I mean, we did a project in Thomaston called the Rural Heritage Centre, and the lady that is a delightful lady called Gail Etheridge down there who runs the place, and she'll tell you how her gift shop looks. She feels that it looks like a New York gallery. Okay. You know, it brings you goosebumps when she says things like that. So,
you know, something that strikes me when I look at pictures of, and some of us are hoping to come down there, so looking.
Oh, you should! It's much better. Really, it's much better than on.
Sort of just looking at visually at the place, the natural world, the landscape of that part of Alabama. It's absolutely beautiful. The natural world is beautiful, lush.
Yes.
And then you read. You know, and I've read a lot of what a lot of journalists have written about the rural studio and also just that part of the country, and they'll describe the buildings that human beings have built and lived in with words like abandoned, tumble down, sagging, rusted. It is so striking. You know, if you think of human beings as creatures among creatures, and we're supposed to be the intelligent ones with consciousness, but that somehow what the human beings have crafted or have accepted is so much less beautiful than the natural landscape. And then what strikes me also is that the buildings the rural studio has built are also really compatible. You know, they kind of aspire to that same kind of beauty.
Well, that's nice of you to say so. I mean, I again, it's an optimistic world and it's an ambitious world. I mean, I think one of the things that always distresses me a little bit is that the descriptions of the Black Belt and West Alabama are always, they're always biased towards the social strife and the social and political strife, mm-hmm. and some of the poverty, and it is of course there is an extraordinary sort of burden of history, but from my point of view, I've found a place where there's sort of extraordinary optimism. I mean, and an incredible dignity. I mean, you may well, when you've been looking at the Royal Studio stuff, have come across a lady called Alberta Bryant, who was actually one of the first clients, mm-hmm. well, the first client for the first project, and she is struck down by diabetes and has lost both of her legs. But I think it's impossible to imagine a more positive a lady who is just, I mean, she should be very angry with her lot, mm-hmm. I mean, and disappointed with her life, but you could never never wish to meet somebody with a greater sense of humor, a greater dignity than this woman. I mean, even in her sort of handicapped situation that she's in now, there's no bitterness, there's no anger at all. It's wonderful to find people like that who are just simply not spending their days complaining.
Right. You know? Tell me about the house that Royal Studio built for her.
It was the first one, mm-hmm. and it was made of straw bales, and it was covered in stucco, and I guess initially sort of Sambo rolled into West Alabama and started talking to people about helping them, and I'm fairly certain the story, as I know, is that you know, that these folks really did not trust that a white guy would show up in Mason's Bend and want to build them a home. You know, mm-hmm. why I don't believe this. Why would that happen? And you know, lo and behold, 6 months later they'd done it, and you know, in some respects, the rest of it is history. I mean, it's a project that very much has Samuel Mockbee's hands all over it. It's very, very clever. It's a kind of classic. I would say it's sort of got the classic southern porch, the great family room on mm-hmm. the exterior. It's very, very simple inside. Very simple, two very simple bedrooms and a bathroom, and then these sort of three wonderful little sort of wagon wheels that stick out of the back that are very, very small circular rooms that the nephews and nieces could come and sort of lay down in. And it's very smart. You know, mm-hmm. they can be used for storage, they can be used in different ways, but fundamentally they were about the extended family. And mm-hmm. even today, I don't know which generation it is that's running in and out of the house, but if you go down there, you'll find the kids in those little sort of nooks in the back of the house enjoying them. Mm-hmm. It's very beautiful.
Where was she living before?
They were living in back to the kind of characterized West Alabama landscape. They were living in a broken down shack, literally right next to the building. It didn't have any running water, didn't have any electricity, and it's extraordinary that in sort of 21st century United States of America that you can find those sorts of conditions. You know, really ridiculous.
You know, I want to ask you about some of the words that Samuel Mockbee used to talk about architecture in the Royal Studio. And I'd like to know, you know,
he only ever used four-letter words in my presence.
Oh, really? I don't have any of those in writing. well, one of them was subversive.
Yeah.
In fact, yeah. I think I've seen you in Britain using that word.
Flying under the radar.
Yeah, well, tell me what is subversive about your vision of architecture.
Oh, I don't... Well, it's always nice to characterize yourself as a radical, but I don't know that I've ever really truly seen us as being radical. I think all that we're trying to do is is the right thing. I mean, there's many things that we can do in West Alabama, and we try to enjoy life. I mean, I think that the act and art of building is such a positive and optimistic thing. I mean, just seeing something come out of the ground is incredible. Mm. But when you would see Sambo barreling around West Alabama in a big red truck and making jokes, an incredible spirit and somewhat of a radical, because he decided he was going to reject the conventional way of teaching architecture and engaging mm-hmm. students of architecture and even practicing architecture, and let's go and find a place in the middle of nowhere and try and build something very beautiful. And if there's anything, well, I mean, if that's incredibly radical, well, so be it. It's radical, but mm-hmm. I don't know that I think about when I wake up every day, I'm going to run off and be radical. My goodness, I mean, okay. I guess I've chosen a lifestyle that people with my kind of silly education wouldn't necessarily choose. I mean, I've chosen a place where I can, help to give students a really fantastic education for life, and at the same time help some folks, and that's rewarding. It's selfish in lots of ways. Mm. I mean, it's
so rewarding.
Yeah, I think right. so. Why not?
And what about this insistence that he spoke about for honesty in architecture? Mm. What did he mean by that word? And I mean, what does it mean to you?
Well, I think if you talk about it from an architectural point of view, I think that there's a number of ways to describe that. I mean, if you talk, for example, about structural honesty, it means that you can actually understand the way that a building stands up. So you see how the forces, how the weight of the roof is taken down to the ground, for example. Mm. And very often buildings are sort of made in such a gymnastic way that you can't understand any of that. And I think that, I'm not wishing to speak for Sambo, but I think that things are often overly complicated and also camouflaged, so you really can't tell what's going on. And I think that my sense of a sort of an architectural honesty would be, well, if this thing is made of straw bales or of cardboard, I can actually understand it to be made of cardboard. Mm-hmm. But also an architecture without pretension, that it's not pretending to be something that it isn't.
Right.
One of the really beautiful things about a place like West Alabama is that there are many, many antebellum homes still remaining in West Alabama. Mm. And, you know, you were talking about the sort of the decay and the detritus of West Alabama, but it also has an amazing sort of many of the homes that were built.
The big white houses.
The big white houses, mm-hmm. absolutely, mm-hmm. are tremendously well built, very, very cleverly built. And they've survived not just because they're big white houses and that they're cared for, but because they were very smart. They have big roofs, they're very well ventilated. They have big porches, they have big window openings. They're easy to ventilate.
Mm-hmm.
Just street smarts, you know. Mm-hmm. And they're held off the ground, and our students go and look at them every day. And it's not to sort of copy the big white white architecture, but it's to sort of think about the street smarts of it. I mean, today our contemporary society is housing people in tin cans in trailer homes where there are very few openings. Everybody has the air conditioner. You have two seasons. You have the air conditioning season and you have the heating season. And
right.
it's dreadful, and mm-hmm. it's very unsocial. And there's no community to it, and it's very sad that we have we've forgotten how to live, I think, and if anything, I hope that our 20K house can battle against that and give people something that feels like. I mean, it's very odd to me that the trailers are so successful, because they are these sort of sealed tin cans that people live in, and they don't. Maybe they feel secure in them, but They're not very well built. They have, you know, they have sort of a built-in obsolescence.
Mm-hmm.
So after I've paid all of this money on my credit terms over so many years, after 20 years, the thing has fallen to bits because it's so badly built. And mm-hmm. I you know, I'm probably getting off the subject here, but I think that's makes me very angry. We have forgotten how to live. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and it's going to come back and bite us because, you know, we can't afford to run all of these air conditioning units, so we've got to figure out natural ways to do it and rediscover just what the Romans and the Greeks did. You know, my goodness sake, it's not you don't have to look back very far, even into West Alabama, to see that they survived without air conditioning pretty damned well.
Right. Something that you've written about that I find quite interesting is how. You know, you said that, you know, Samuel Mockbee died before he could really reap all the lessons of some of the buildings you'd built. That, you know, something that you experience now that you see.
I probably
homes,
didn't say it quite that way.
Well, you see homes and buildings that people have lived in, and you see also what can be done better and, you know, what didn't work because there was so much that was experimental. I mean, in those early years, I don't know if you're still doing this, it was something that was, it was often commented on as the wild materials with which carpet samples, tires, bales of hay, as you said, and
cardboard bales.
Cardboard.
I was involved in a number of those projects, they're very beautiful, and don't get me wrong, but in some respects they're sort of. There may well be sort of recycling one-liners. One of the things that I'm very proud of is that the Royal Studio has turned into sort of recycling buildings. We've taken buildings that probably other people would tear down and said, well, no, this building has some value. What can we put our time and energy into this building to remake it, reuse it, and make it useful to contemporary life? That also doesn't mean that that building disappears. So that the sort of the collective memory. I mean, when people go home or people go and visit a place, neighborhoods in places like Chicago at the moment change so quickly, where the yuppieization of neighborhoods, where they sort of come in like a plague of locusts and completely change the nature and scale of neighborhoods. And it's not that it's a bad thing, it's just that it's so fast. And you know, you can walk down the street the next minute and it's changed instantly. And I don't, you know, we can talk for hours as to whether or not that's a good thing and whether it's progress. But I don't know how that allows you to consider that place as home if it's changing, if your environs are changing so rapidly. And here we can't just throw things away. The easiest thing is not to just throw things away. So we've really concentrated on remaking and reusing. We rebuilt a church. We actually literally demolished a church and used between 70% and 80% of the materials.
So you took it down, but you then reused the materials for a completely different structure.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And the congregation knew and understand that. And they really delighted in that fact, you know. And
You actually retain the history while also doing something completely new.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think typically anybody else would have just pushed it into a pile and burnt it. And we took the time to recycle it and plane off some of the white paint that was on the church and reuse it. And they love that. They know that. They feel that. And that, I think, spiritually is incredibly important. Mm-hmm. We recycle as much as we can. The issue that comes up when you do recycle and you take chances on some of these materials and you do experiments is that they may fail or they may have to be refinished.
Mm-hmm,
and
mm-hmm.
In a place where there's no money for maintenance, we have to look to use where our sort of focus, particularly with some of the public buildings, has been to say, well, look, I can't guarantee that we can come back and rebuild this or that the people can afford the paint to repaint this. So we've tried not to do that. We try to literally use materials that have a natural lifespan of their own that's as long as we can possibly find, but they don't rely on any level of maintenance. And that's
fascinating.
It's incredibly important.
Yeah.
It probably has meant that we've lost some of the colorful things, you know, because most of the color is provided by, you know, bright yellow paint or something. And maybe we'll rediscover ways to do that, but it's really been born of necessity. At the beginning of every year, the Royal Studio doesn't have very many books. In fact, it struggles to keep a library. And what we do at the beginning of every year is we take a tour of all the projects, and we take a critical tour of the projects. And in fact, at the beginning of every year, we even go and work on some of the projects to fix them up and to clean them and that kind of thing. And it's an encyclopedia. And if I would be a very bad teacher and a bad architect and a bad human being, I think, if I didn't take the students out and start to say, look, here was the intention here. Here's what we tried. What do you think? Do you think it failed? Do you think it worked? Look at this example over here. I think this has failed, and I think over here this has worked. And I let them decide. And I don't tell them. I simply make some observations and let them decide for themselves.
And the buildings themselves are the encyclopedia, you're saying?
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, it's a terrific... I mean, we're building, six, seven, eight projects every year, so there's a sort of an extraordinary catalog of different ways of doing things.
So I just, I think when you've spoken about, and this is in being responsive to the communities in which you're building these buildings, the families and the communities, that these are, as you say, these are not people who are going to have money for big maintenance and refurbishing projects every few years. And you also say that if they have time to be working, they shouldn't be volunteering on houses. They should be out earning money, right?
So absolutely.
And yet you use a phrase you've used so that you're aiming for zero maintenance structures. I mean, what an amazing concept. I mean, talk about sustainability, which is now a catchword for everyone.
It's unfortunate that it's so commercially used. I think it's become incredibly devalued, and we use the term sustainability with a small s. We will, there's always a lot of questions. People come and see the work and say, well, why aren't you using composting toilets, or why aren't you using solar panels? And the answer to the truth of the matter is not just that the huge upfront costs of things like that, but the fact of the matter is that I am better off making sure that if I put in a septic system, that the local people can fix it if it fails. And for me, that's sustainability with a small s. It's not trying to reinvent the wheel. It's simply recognizing the capabilities of local people when they're dealing with essential services. And it's perhaps not particularly ambitious, but you have to choose your moments with those things, I think. I mean, if you find the appropriate person who you believe can maintain it, well, yes, we will do it. But then the problem is that relies on that person. And then what happens if that person leaves? Then you're in a mess, So it's an odd thing. All of the discussion about how the forms and things of the Royal Studio are strange and look very different and to contemporary life. But at the Royal Studio, we very rarely actually have a conversation about the sort of the stylistic nature of the architecture. It's more often it's about, well, how do I decide which material to use here? And I hope that often the forms are actually driven by the materials. The fact, for example, that, corrugated tin, if you put a sheet of corrugated tin upon the wall, it's easier to cut it one way than it is to cut it the other way. So somehow the form and the shape and the kind of the grain of the material can actually begin to generate the form of the building. You respond to the type of material that you're using. And it very rarely do we say, well, I want to do a tower because it looks cool. I mean, it's not...
It might end up looking cool, but that's not what comes first.
Well, exactly. Uh-huh. I mean, it isn't at all. I think that another thing is that we've really tried to do relative to sustainability out here is to understand the long-term sustainability of the programming. Because if you give somebody a public building,
right.
if there's no right. money for the long-term programming of that, the building will fail if it's empty. And that's, I mean, I've been, you know, extraordinarily proud over the last few years of how really 50% of the work that our students do is working on the programming of the building, the long-term survival of the building, which is not just about the architecture. It's about who's going to work here, how are we going to fund this, do you, you know, getting into the grant writing, getting into the talking to different organizations who will be getting involved to make sure that they have enough legs to keep to help us to help the building survive and what happens in it survive inside
and
it.
Is survive, there a synergistic yeah. relationship? I mean, do you think that that having an architecture of decency, that's one of the terms that's yeah. used of this, having an architecture of decency,
yeah, that's
housing
funny, that
a
one.
Project or program, does that also is that also something
absolutely.
That strengthens
I mean,
and supports the program?
It's responsible. I mean, it's responsibility at the root of it. I mean, I you know, we could certainly go off and say you know, I mean, in Hale County, we're just building an animal shelter, and I think that the students spent their entire first term educating the client as to what they needed to do to offer the citizens of Hale County an animal shelter in terms of liability, in terms of insurance, in terms of collecting money to make sure that this thing worked. And that's just part of the responsibility that I think that architects need to accept. Mm. I mean, before Sambo died, we used to talk about the education of a citizen architect. And I think it's students and architects understanding the broader the bigger, broader societal responsibilities that they can have and take on. I mean, we shape the environment. There are very, you know, when planning and planners were so sort of badly mauled in the 60s and 70s, they've lost their sort of ability to dream about the way that we live. And if we don't have those folks doing that, that means probably that the architects are the only ones who can be the societal dreamers. And we're for West Alabama, we're incredibly optimistic. We want people to dream about having a better world. And that's, you know, what better to have than a bunch of 22-year-olds who are just, you know, have got so much energy and will, you know, walk through walls to try and make it happen. And it becomes infectious. People love to be part of it. I mean, they just, you know, I hope to get you get to meet some of the clientele because they, you know, the people have just been blown away by the energy and commitment and enthusiasm that students bring to these projects. I mean, this last, you know, in the last few years, the students taking on these community projects have actually virtually accepted that their project will take 2 years, even though technically they're only out here for a year's education. So they graduate on May the 5th and then they spend an extra year building and finishing off their projects just because they want to. And that's like, wow, you know, what a young person that is to walk off into the world having shown that they can make that kind of commitment to the world and to society. And that's just, for me, it gives me goosebumps that they'll do that. You know, it's more than just give me my diploma, give me my degree, find me a job. That's like, goodness, this has some worth. You know, this has some value.
You know, the word charity is a word that Samuel Mockbee used, and I think the word itself has become problematic. But it does. The reasons it's become problematic also have to do with kind of a fine line between helping other people and being paternalistic, or between making lives better. Right? How do you? You know, is that a line you walk? How do you think about this? Is charity a word you use, or are there words you prefer that kind of evoke the best of that?
I was trying to think about the term charity on the way up, and you know, I struggle with it a great deal. I mean, I was saying about being educated by people in England who rebuilt the country, and that wasn't based on charity. That was the social state and the state and the government saying we need to do this for the collective good. And for my students particularly, we don't really talk about it being charity. I'll be absolutely frank to you that what we see as being the exchange that's taking place here is that our client is a good and willing and interested and observant and rigorous and questioning client. And that's the privilege that we have in that situation. That yes, we will work with you. We want to listen to you. We want you to be very critical about what we do. Don't just say give us anything. And it's not a bad exchange, actually. I mean, we work with people who don't know what an architect does, so we have to educate them as to what an architect can bring to a situation. We educate them to understand drawings, to engage in a conversation about spaces, to engage in, you know, the question of what do you want when people have never been asked what they want. I mean, it's a remarkable thing for, you know, and particularly at architectural school where you learn such nonsense. You learn archi-speak, and here these our students have to go out into communities and make presentations, and we rehearse those presentations because there's no point in using architectural mumbo jumbo. You have to be very clear, and you have to kind of critically lay out what the strategies are for the decisions and allow them to be engaged with it on their terms. Otherwise, you've failed.
Right.
Same with the drawings, the words and the drawings. You know, they have to, we make lots of models, we make lots of perspectives so people can begin, or at least try to begin, to imagine themselves in that place. And because they've never been asked to do that before. They've never been asked to imagine before.
And I think that,
that's an amazing situation to be in as a student.
I think. Just the fact that you do...
I've never answered your question.
Well, no, you are answering it, I think. And yeah, but you're saying, I think just the fact that the whole premise of this is you're building homes for people who could never afford them and who could never really afford something, as you say, never imagined living in a beautiful, functional space. But you call them clients and you treat them as clients. And, I've watched this, there's a video about Rural Studio and where you really get a chance to see, let's say, one family, a mother with five children, go through that process, and it's stunning to watch.
Well,
that
it's all about respect
with her children, and it absolutely is an exchange, and she's asking lots of questions, and there is incredible respect that is palpable.
It's not simply a case of us offloading a gift to people. People would misunderstand it if they saw it that way. It's an exchange between people who've never met each other before, and with people who have never worked with architects, it's extraordinarily difficult to engage at many levels because in our everyday lives, everybody has different aspirations, and so how do you begin to understand the aspirations of folks who have not been asked what they want? And it's a profound and sometimes it's quite upsetting for students that they perceive that the client doesn't care. And it's not that the client doesn't care, it's simply that the client just has other priorities. It's like, I need to put food on the table, I need to be warm and dry, I don't care about that. It's not the first thing that comes to mind when that,
it seems to me that when we talk about sustainability, we tend to talk about materials, and I think people have zeroed in on the Rural Studio's use of recycled materials. But you're really also engaged in sustaining human beings and human resources, and I don't think it's just the clients; it's also the students, in a way, isn't it? I mean, it's you. How do you think about the success? I mean, how do you think about success, or what success means to you in terms of the human beings you're working with on every side of that equation?
Uh, I hope success for me would be sort of positive, ultimately positive critical reflection on their experience. I mean, they go into these sort of whirlwind experiences that are so intense. I mean, a friend of mine used to say, you know, being in a rural studio thesis is somewhat similar to being at the Russian front. I mean, it's just incredibly, you know, it's a tough place, and a lot of questions are asked of people. I mean, the students work in teams, and so you can, I mean, I have often said to people that I cannot imagine achieving what my students achieve, because I really consider that they do remarkably mature things for people that are 22 and 23 years old. And when I was that age, I could never decide what I liked or what I didn't like. I mean, particularly from a design point of view, I might know what I didn't like, but deciding what I liked was actually very difficult, and even starting to kind of communicate it and draw it was more difficult. But not only do the students at the Royal Studio have to decide that, but they then have to communicate it and fight it out with each other, and then convey it to a client. And that I find that just mind-blowing, that the sort of the speed and the intensity of that, because I don't think I was capable of that until, you know, middle of my 30s, even to begin to be able to do that. And so I'm very proud that they're able to. You know, they in some respects they come into the studio and they need a lot of hand holding, and then at various points in the education they begin to fly the nest and they take control. And it's a lovely thing. It's not for the faint hearted, believe me, but they suddenly begin to understand who to go to ask the right questions of, where to find the information, and they build a confidence. And it's a confidence of learning by doing. And for me, that's when they begin to fly the nest and they make wonderful, kind of very considered, rigorous decisions. I mean, you know, you look at something and they've been through 1,000 hours of talking about this and figuring it out, and then they do it and they decide and they make the right and they make sustainable choices that are all, yes, they're beautiful, and hopefully they lift the spirit and they have a little bit of stamango, but also more importantly that they'll last a heck of a long time. And for me, that's success, when they start to make those sorts of decisions. But I mean, as you know, as human beings, I hope they go off in the world, you know, believing that, like I did or do, that, you know, that you can have an impact on the world and make the world a little bit of a better place. I mean, Sambo, certainly, I mean, he was very clear that getting yourself an education was not about just about the individual, but it was also about, it was, you know, to have an impact on society. And you know, I truly believe in that. So,
I have just a couple more questions for you, and I want to give you a little break. I want to be quiet for a minute while I listen in my headphones. I want to ask my colleagues behind the glass if they, you know, if there's something I haven't asked you, something they're curious about. Or
am I allowed to go and get a drink of water?
Yes, please do. Yeah, go ahead.
Do you mind?
No, that's great. Go do that.
Thank you. Okay. Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay. Are you back, Andrew? Nope. Okay.
Hello, thank you
Hi.
For that.
Hi, that's great. Oh, we'll just, we'll have a couple more minutes. I'm kind of to go to a lofty height here. Here's another great Samuel Mockbee quote. There is something divine in the work of architecture, and we must maintain faith in the wonder of architecture to bring us into accord with the natural world, the supernatural world, with our fellow human beings, and the great unknown. I won't ask you to put that intro in words. What do you, when you hear the phrase "the wonder of architecture," what does that evoke for you?
Goodness, the wonder of architecture. It's interesting living in the world that I live in, and obviously being an architect, you look at architectural magazines, and as an architect, you go and visit all the high and mighty buildings and the famous buildings and the extraordinary achievements. The wonder of architecture. I mean, I think the wonder of architecture. I don't know.
Just talk to me about your passion for architecture. I mean, is there something? Is there something divine in the work of architecture? That's maybe those words don't work for you. But what is it that really excites you? I think
that they can represent the. I mean, there's two moments that sort of spring to mind in terms of what a man can aspire to, and man can be incredibly self-destructive, but man can be also incredibly clever. And I remember taking one of my old professors to Chicago and taking him up the top of the Hancock Tower, and he was a little Japanese guy, and he sat up at the top of the Hancock Tower and looked over that spectacular view of the city of Chicago, and he just sat there and he cried, and he said that he couldn't, he just said, this is just amazing what man can achieve. I think under the right circumstances, architecture can embody everything that is good about humanity. It can also do exactly the opposite, of course. But I think that carefully considered choices that are smart choices that can bring. I mean, architecture can also be incredibly mundane, and architecture has to function and do the job. But I think what I enjoy about what I do is that even in the most banal of circumstances, we will try our damnedest, not only to make sure that it lasts a long time, but that people sort of get a kick out of using it and enjoy it, and that it makes their life a little bit better. And so perhaps that's, for me, was what the wonder of architecture can potentially be. I think in the contemporary world, we do a lot of things because we can. And in West Alabama, I enjoy the conversations about what is the right thing to do and what we should do rather than what we can do. Because I think we can, you can do almost anything. And, a lot of the architects today, I look at the way that it's made and it feels like it's sort of, it's pushing the boundaries of what we can do. But I don't know that it's necessarily what we should do.
Okay.
And, I'm not going to give examples, but what we should do is an incredibly difficult and provocative thing to answer, I think, in most circumstances, I think particularly architecturally, because with the technology of today and with the computers that we have and what that has brought to the world, they're quite, I think the possibilities are quite incredible, but I think it also, in the hands of the wrong people, I think that they can also be incredibly, what am I trying to say here? I think those tools can be misused, and again, it can be about excess, and that issue because we can I struggle with this issue that we can. I mean, I think it's obviously we can is an incredibly positive attitude towards life. Yes, we can do this, but I'd always like to temper it with the question, well, is it the right thing to do and should we do this? I'm starting to waffle now.
No, it's good. It's good. I know that the Rural Studio really, really has been from its inception and continues to develop and evolve a particular ethic of architecture, doesn't it? Vision, but not just a vision of what architecture is and can do and should do, but really an ethic.
Yes. Well, I hope that again I get back to the sort of the question of our students and architects understanding their broader responsibility. I think that.
Where do the students go? I mean, what do you follow? What happens to them? Do they move back out into that more traditional world of architecture?
It's an odd thing. I mean, I have to kind of I can give you examples where there's a handful of students who've begun to go off and sort of make their way and be provocative about the way they practice and who they practice for and how they practice. But I think typically, I mean, the studio is only 15 years old. So
right.
If the kids were 20, 22 when they left here, that means they're in their mid-30s now.
Yeah.
You have to also go and understand the playing field in which you're playing. And the playing field of West Alabama is slightly different to that one, the work environment that typically most of them will go into. They want to go and experience it to understand it. And most of them will call me up and say, well, why didn't you tell me? A lot of them, they don't like to be sat behind a computer screen, I have to be honest with you, and that's a disappointment for them. But I hope that we empower a lot of them to be critical about the way that they run their lives and about those sorts of the decisions about how I want to live my life as an architect. Mm-hmm. If I want to live my life as an architect sat behind a computer, well, that's fine. But if I don't, I hope that our students are sort of critically motivated enough to be able to make a decision not to and say, well, perhaps there's other ways to live and there's other ways to do what we do.
Mm.
And I think that again, it's very difficult to say. I do hope, and I do believe actually that probably in the next 10 years, a number of these folks are going to rise up and start to do some different things that are a sort of a provocative response to their education. Because I think that when they go out into the typical working environment, it's polemically different, but it also offers an opportunity to reflect on the way that their education they got at the Rural Studio. And I hope they do take, I hope they do understand the potentials of the responsibilities that they have, and I hope they do take with them the sort of the ethic of the Rural Studio. I think a lot of contemporary students and contemporary society I'm always quite shocked by how unaffected my students are by some of the social conditions that they find. But I don't know that they're necessarily to blame themselves. It's just, I don't know, it's not of their world, and it doesn't matter how much you put it in front of them. I do find that strange sometimes, but for some of them, it's a profound situation that they find themselves in, and they really get very angry about it. So it's very, the impact can be very different across a broad range of students, you know.
I wonder how, in these years, how long have you been at the Rural Studio altogether?
I think 7 or 8 years.
7 or 8 years.
Like.
Mm. How has your, how have you changed, either as a designer, as an architect, or as a human being?
I've probably become more and more difficult. I suspect I've aged beyond my years. When Sambo died, suddenly I became the father figure.
Yes.
And I was at that point the sort of the young buck who was, the European young buck who showed up and was wild and interesting, and I've got plenty of gray hair now, and it's an acquired taste is running this organization, because it's very emotional. I mean, the weather can change the emotions of the Rural Studio dramatically. If we have a bad wet winter and people are wandering around with their feet caked in Hale County clay, they get miserable pretty quickly because they can't build. And then in the midst of summer, they're similarly miserable because it's 100 degrees and 100% humidity, and they're wondering, what the hell am I doing here, And so I have to be the kind of the emotional sponge for all of that one. So I think, generally speaking, at the point of a nervous breakdown would be a nice way to summarize where I find myself.
Wait, aren't you getting ready to take a sabbatical also? In response
to
that?
I'm going to go and find a beach somewhere.
Is that what you're going to do?
If I told you, I'd have to kill you.
Okay. But you are going to get a break now.
It's an addictive and an extraordinarily, it really is a drug. Mm-hmm. And the attitude, in a conventional design studio, where a professor sits across from a student and they talk about what they might draw, the professor has to sort of provoke with different or ask questions. At the Rural Studio, something is at stake. You don't want the rain to fall on the client. They have a budget to deal with. They have all of the kind of moral dilemmas of dealing with codes and dealing with, just what do I give this client that will be the right thing? And I think the fact that something is at stake here is really extraordinary. And you get all of these sort of wonderful donations from people who are very generous, And when a donation shows up, suddenly the student has to redesign their project. And I, as a professor, I'm not begging them to do that. They just do it. Mm-hmm. They do it without even thinking. So the sort of the iterative process that most often is instigated by the teacher at the Royal Studio, it happens simply through events, through meetings, through events such as the material showing up and somebody giving you a bunch of steel or a bunch of wood, and you start to say, well, you know, how could I use this so I don't waste it, so I don't throw it away, or you know, what could it bring to my project that's powerful and isn't going to cost me anything? And this issue of something being at stake, I think, is also I you know, incredibly powerful. I'm very lucky to do what I do. I mm-hmm. mean, the
but it's hard. I mean, yeah. I hear that.
I mean, it's very emotional. I mean, it's the fact that it's not a top down education. It's a bottom up education. I never say no. All I do is I keep asking them questions and hope that they will come to the right conclusions themselves. And so, it's a hand holding process. And they get very frustrated with it. They get very frustrated with themselves, and they ask a lot of questions for themselves, both emotionally, intellectually, and physically, because mm-hmm. they're designing and they're building, and they've never done it before.
Right.
They're out on the edge, and they're also, you know, they're focused, and they're working in a team that's, I mean, it's, you know, it's a marriage, and they, you know, they have to figure it out and negotiate it, and mm-hmm. they've never really had to do any of that before. So I'm the marriage counselor in there, sort of negotiating all of the time, saying it'll be okay and giving them confidence, which is really, you know, you give folks the opportunity, and it's remarkable what they will do. I mean, it's all about opportunity. And, and you know, I always remember that Sambo's talking about. And whenever anybody came in with an idea, Sambo would grab it and run with it at 100 miles an hour. It was, you know, now's the moment. Let's get on to the next great opportunity. And it was incredibly optimistic and positive and entrepreneurial. And I hope that the students sort of take that away with them, because to make the most of every situation, I think, is incredibly important.
Right. I just want to ask you two more quick questions. I've kept you a long time. Before Samuel Mockbee died, he was beginning to receive some great awards and honors, and you have also received great awards and honors. Do you feel that this ethic, this aesthetic and ethic and vision of, about architecture of the Rural Studio is affecting the field?
Well, I hope so. I mean, I think it was, you know, Samuel Mockbee getting the AIA gold medal, I think sent a very strong message not only to the profession but also to the public that this work and working with these people, i.e. giving poor folks architecture and not just rich folks architecture, was actually kind of a profoundly important thing and an important part of our society. I mean, you know, recently we were asked to, this actually a couple of, 18 months ago, we were asked to go and represent the United States at a Biennale in Brazil, at the Sao Paulo Biennale. And the feedback from the exhibit, and there was hundreds of exhibits from all over the world, each country.
Architects?
Had,
and,
yes. Mm-hmm. It was an architectural exhibition. And, mm-hmm. and we were chosen by the State Department and the AIA to go and represent the United States. And the feedback from the exhibit was that everybody was so excited that that's what was chosen to represent the United States of America, and not you know, the contemporary illustration of American architecture, but something in a rural, relatively poor place, and that was also built by a bunch of young people. And I think that's an incredibly good and positive thing to hear about the United States of America, that people are saying, well, yeah, that's something that's good coming out of a place like West Alabama.
All right. And when you think about, when we started talking, you talked about how you were energized when you first experienced Samuel Mockbee by the sense that, you know, that there was worth in this profession that you chose, and that's something you wanted and were drawn to. And, you know, if you look at what you've learned or gotten out of this, or if you look at the place, not really the students, I think you've talked a lot about the students, but the people in the region or that part of Alabama. I think you're now you're an honorary citizen of Marion, Alabama. Somewhere. Is that right? how do you think about that? When you know, what words would you put to what the worth of this is? Why it matters?
Oh, well. Sorry, I was going to say something. I completely forgot what I was going to say. Sorry. Can you repeat the question?
Yeah. Well, just this phrase that you know, that it's a worthy profession, that you wanted the work, the way you were an architect to have worth. Yeah. How do you measure that? How do you look around and say, you know, that's true and this is this is what
I would. I mean, as opposed to my teachers in London or in England, they were able to make such large, sweeping, bold moves. And in West Alabama, what you really appreciate is small victories, very incremental interventions. There's no money to do huge, great master plans and huge, great visions. But what you do is just sort of one little piece at a time. And it's a nice environment to work in, because what exists, particularly at the political level and at the local government level, the politicians are very, they fight for what they've got. You know, they will come and, I mean, for example, we're working in a public park, Lyons Park, and there was an area of asphalt, and I always say the word asphalt wrong, asphalt.
Asphalt, yes.
Asphalt. My students will love that. But our inclination, we wanted to take automobiles out of the park, and our inclination was to tear up that piece of asphalt. And the local judge said, "No, we can't do that. You know, that represented a substantial public investment, for us, and you have to understand that I for one don't think that you should do that." And what that forced us to do was to begin to make creative interventions into that piece of asphalt that was a parking lot and is no longer a parking lot. It's now a pedestrian surface. And our students have begun to imagine ways of dealing with that surface and putting planting in that surface that softens it, that stops it taking in so much heat, that makes it more beautiful. And he challenged us. And if he just said tear it up, we'd have torn it up. But he said, no, this was a value. And for me, those little acts, I mean, these sort of small victories for both, evidence of people caring about their environment and saying, you know, this represents hard-earned public money, and we don't think that you should do that. So, you know, think about it another way. And it was just a marvelous example of a local politician saying, you've been doing the right thing and saying the right thing and provoking us into thinking laterally about the way we were going to deal with our preconceptions of this surface. Because everybody thinks of asphalt as being, it's automobiles, and our students have been provoked into this situation of making a surface that will be unlike any surface anywhere in the world. And, you know, you know, it'll be changed completely, but it's those small changes and valuing what exists, that you can't just go in there and tear it up and start again with everything. And I enjoy that sort of the, well, I delight in the sort of the beginning to sort of fix to the fabric, you know, sew together in very, very small ways, both architecturally, but also sort of community-wise. Mm-hmm.
And families, you know, and individuals' lives as well.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. That's the sustainability, the sustainable aspect of that. You know, maybe if we have a good public park in West Alabama, kids will stay in West Alabama. I mean, Don Ballard, who works for Alabama Power locally and is on the Lions Park Committee, you know, his family have gone off to university and all that, and he's a local guy who's got involved with this park, and his, you know, he has nothing to gain from this other than he wants to make Greensboro a really good place to live. Mm. He doesn't feel that it needs to get a Nissan plant or a Toyota plant. He just wants it to be a good place with a good education and good public parks. And I love that guy. I mean, I think he's, you know, he is a fantastic member of a community and has real vision and has nothing to gain from having that real vision. And he comes to public meetings. He'll be at a public meeting on Monday night to talk about the future of the park and what our students are doing. And it's great when you see someone like that who has nothing to gain. He's not a teacher. He's just a guy. And he steps up and says, you know, we should do this because it's the right thing to do for our town.
Right. It's a citizen incredible. Meeting you, citizen architects.
Absolutely. Uh-huh. Absolutely.
All right. I think I've worn you out, but this has been really wonderful.
Well,
and
thank you.
We will be able to gather other voices, you know, down there.
Oh, great.
There.
Yeah, no,
and I think
I mean,
the combination is going to be wonderful. Anything I didn't ask you about? Anything else you really want to say?
No, I could talk forever. I don't know. It's a, you know, the Rural Studio is a compelling story. I mean, it's a, you know, the Rural Studio is a great idea and a fantastic story. And, you know, Mockbee, I don't know if you know, if you've understood the sort of the history of Sambo, but I mean, it was an amazing few years that I had with him contracting leukemia.
Yeah.
And then, you know, that he
died very suddenly, didn't he?
Yeah, but he got a transplant off his sister.
Mm-hmm.
He got a bone marrow transplant off his sister, who then subsequently died of cancer.
Mm.
And we thought we had 3 years, he was 3 years in remission, and we really thought that he'd kicked it.
Yeah.
And he was running around like a maniac, and I was just kind of clearing up the mess behind him. But I mean, it took an amazing and powerful personality to set this thing up. I mean, I have to say, it's not just anybody who could just go into the middle of nowhere and convince other people to follow him and do this. I mean, what I do is the easy part. What he did with no help and having to go out there as this kind of strange and wacky guy with a beard and just in the middle of nowhere with a bunch of kids and really begin to set up the foundation for it. That was the real work. And I will ever be in admiration of that. Just fantastic. Because he could have had a much easier life than doing that. So,
well, I think what you do sounds pretty exacting too. And I wish you a restful sabbatical.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for taking the time to do this.
Well, okay. Thank you. I hope that we can talk about the... I mean, I don't know who... You want to talk to me at some point about who you interview? Because I have ideas for you. So.
Yeah, I think my producer... I think they're working on that and may be in touch with you, but I'm not doing that myself, so... You'll also know what's happening with this, and we're working a couple months ahead of time. So,
all right, terrific.
Yeah,
that is great. Thank you.
Well,
very much.
Great. Thank you. Bye bye.
All right, take care. Bye bye.